Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 2 of For the Record Program 626, interview with Paris Flamand, A Whole New Form of Government. This is being recorded on February 24th of the year 2008. And once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airways Paris Flamand, the author of, among other titles, The 1969 Kennedy Conspiracy, and the just-published four-volume opus, The Assassination of America, dealing with, at a primary level, the assassination of President Kennedy, but also dealing with, literally, the assassination of America, the death of a once proud and, in my opinion, great nation. And, also Paris was the producer of the Long John Nebel Show, arguably the seminal entity in that genre. In many ways, it was the daddy or the mother of all phone-in talk shows. Paris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good to be with you, Dave.
We were talking a little bit about the oil industry and about trouble on oil waters, so to speak, and about the Hunt family who were deeply involved with the events surrounding Kennedy's assassination. Penn Jones, in particular, one of the people you memorialize in The Assassination of America, talked about the Hunt family and the Kennedy assassination. Would you like to fill us in a little bit about the Hunts and how they figure into this scenario?
Well, the Hunts are among the original oil entrepreneurs of Texas. There was a group. There was the Oilmen's Club in Houston that had them all as members. Sid Richardson and H.L. Hunt and his son Howard Hughes and various other people that have less reputation and. The original point of the club was that they cornered the market on American oil production, excuse me, and which they successfully did. As a matter of fact, Hunt had a preoccupation with cornering the market on products, and he once almost he came within. About 90% of cornering the market on silver. He bought and bought and bought and bought and bought, and that is the kind of operation that, if you do not pull it off, it's almost a total catastrophe. And he just missed by a small margin getting the entire lock on the product, and namely silver, and he lost a huge amount of money, which he did soon recover by his oil investments. Hughes was actually, his father was in the oil business, but Hughes himself, who was an extraordinarily brilliant man, unlike most of these other oil people who were essentially businessmen and investors. Hughes was an inventor and an extraordinary intelligence, and he invented a hyper-perfect drill, which improved the mechanical process of drilling for oil enormously, and that enhanced his Hewell and Dye Corporation financial structure enormously. And of course, he designed and built airplanes, flew around the world, and so on and so forth. So he himself is a brilliant example of the American entrepreneur, inventor, adventurer. Of course, he was a producer of Hollywood films. He produced The Outlaw with Jane Russell's being introduced and whatever. So the whole gestalt of oil production and oil people in Texas was a world of its own and in its own. And they created, of course, to a great extent, although the predilection had preceded them from a historic and psychological point of view, of making Texas a country within a country. Of course, it had been an independent country for a very short time, but was then absorbed into the United States. But it's still, even to this day, I have a very dear friend who lives down there, and when he speaks of Texas, he speaks of it in the same way that a Frenchman or an Italian or an Englishman speaks of France, Italy, or England, as if it were not quite the United States.
I had an interesting experience back in the, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s, I read an article in the paper that something like 43% of high school seniors in Dallas, Texas, could not name the country that bordered the United States on the south. And I mentioned this to a friend of mine, and he said, that's easy. The country that borders the United States on the south is Texas, and which in many ways reflects not only the attitudes of a lot of Texans, but some other people as well. Very quickly about the hunts and the silver market, one of the things that I've pointed out to veteran listeners is that the Al-Qaeda account at the Bank Al-Taqwa, the Muslim Brotherhood being an Islamic fascist institution, was maintained by a guy named Ali bin Musalim. And it came out that there were strong links between an element of the Republican Party called the Islamic Institute, headed up by Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and Talat Altman, a close associate of George Bush, and that this directly intersected with the Bank Al-Taqwa. Ali bin Musalim was found dead in his Lausanne, Switzerland apartment a month after it became public that he was maintaining the Al-Qaeda account at Bank Al-Taqwa. In the Financial Times of London, it mentioned that he earlier was under indictment in the United States in the early 1980s for conspiring, and this would place him in the hunt milieu, for conspiring to corner the silver market. And specifically,
yes,
elements of the Saudis conspired with Nelson Bunker Hunt and the rest of the Hunt family to do that. So this is an element running directly from Dealey Plaza in the events of 11-22-63 on up through September 11th, 2001. Right on up through the bloody and oil-drenched scenario, the blood and oil-drenched landscape that we're now witnessing in the Middle East. Very quickly about the Hunts, too. Herbert Hunt, head of Hunt Oil now, a member of the family, was one of the first people to get an oil concession in Iraq, in what is now the Kurdistan section of Iraq. And previously, he had been a two-time appointee by George W. Bush to the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. And so it's a concatenation that, to a certain extent, has maintained its features for many, many decades now. And whether one is examining 11-22-63 or September 11th, 01, or some of the things going on today, some common elements and even some common individuals can be discerned in many of these scenarios.
Well, you've incorporated a couple of points there that with which I was not familiar. I think you may be a little bit more up to date than I on some of these aspects of the Hunt Empire. And I was trying to remember. There was one other person that was important in that scene.
The Murkisons?
Well, he owned the building.
He
was the owner of the building that the Schoolbook Depository building.
Oh, that was the guy who was the head of the Civil Air Patrol, the national head of the Civil Air Patrol.
Yeah, right.
I've forgotten his name offhand.
Yeah, so have I. But that entire thing of the control of an element, let alone a product, is characteristic, of course, of that group. I wanted to touch on something else. Let me parenthesize by saying the moral and ethical practices of this group, especially in terms of the Bush family, two things have to be made completely clear, and that is that their involvement with the Saudi royal family has been enormous for decades. Tremendous interplay in the oil field and in other investments, and the fact that whether one regards them as commendable royal family or not, one can go back to Prescott Bush who amazingly ended up in the American government, but was dealing with the Nazi government after, and I emphasize after, December 7th, 1941. So the characteristic of that family is supreme opportunism and a considerable lack of ethical cognizance. But all of this leads one to the fact that there are a couple of motions in the House now for the impeachment of Bush, and not for those activities, but because he ordered the National Security Agency to fire to spy on American citizens without obtaining a warrant, because he allegedly used outlawed weapons such as depleted uranium, which is radioactive and may cause contamination of human beings in Iran, in Iraq. So the deterioration of the country is going has come all the way from the Hunt and Ritterin and Bush and that particular contingent who affected elections and had great political power, especially down there, to a point where the Green Party in the United States, for example, which is Ralph Nader's party, is has been pushing strongly for the impeachment of both the president and the vice president in what they call a litany of alleged crimes and misdemeanors, abuses of power, and violations of the U.S. Constitution unknown in preceding history, that both the head of government are exposed to this kind of accusation. And the other point is that John Conyers, the much respected representative, has a bill for impeachment. So this is not some. Kuchinich also introduced a bill for. So this is not a bunch of eccentrics or improbable mythicizers. These are three reputable people and groups who are suggesting that the president and the vice president have been involved in criminal activities for years, and that, in point of fact, though, it is reasonable to assume that nothing will ever come of this.
Oh, yeah.
Because their power is so great that they'll be able to obviate any attacks on them legally.
I was ruminating with a friend of mine who's in the military, as we speak, and I'd read a column by, it was either by Bob Herbert of the New York Times or E.J. Dion of the Washington Post editorial staff, and he was talking about the revival of populist politics during the 2008 campaign, and mentioning how many middle-class Americans felt that America had turned its back on them. And the odd thing is, for both of us, both my friend in the military and for myself, I really felt, certainly I can understand why people feel that way, why people in the middle class feel that America has turned its back on them. But both of our reaction was that in many ways the jilted party could be said to be America. The middle class, to a large extent, turned its back on America. And coming back to the subject of the Kennedy assassination, I am of a later generation of researchers, and in fact, my attention was riveted by reading many of the books in that first generation whom you memorialize, including your own Kennedy conspiracy from 69. But it was when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was formed, and when a great many books came out in the mid-70s about the assassinations, that I was absolutely riveted, and it became apparent very quickly from reading the literature that there had been a massive high-level conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, that it was a coup d'etat, and that the same people had dispatched his brother Robert and Martin Luther King and a great many other people as well. And yet, and even the badly compromised House Select Committee on Assassinations found that there had been a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination and King's, and yet people took no notice at all. I remember very distinct, very, very vividly trying to convince people at work and friends of mine that they should be paying attention to this. You know, this is not, you know, when a Congressional Select Committee concludes that there's been a conspiracy to murder the President of the United States and Martin Luther King, that is not a small thing. That goes to the very core of American civic existence, and people took no note of it. And to this day, one of the things that Garrison pointed out, and I'd like you to expand on this, Paris, is that, you know, people are waiting for German-style fascism from the 1930s, and it's not going to be that so much, but that it is already here, and that the real cudgel, so to speak, of American fascism, and that is basically what happened on November 22nd, 1963, was the coming of fascism to America, is the culture itself. Even though a Congressional Select Committee concluded there'd been a conspiracy to murder the President of the United States, if one espouses the conspiratorial view of the Kennedy assassination, one is viewed automatically as a nut, as a fringe figure and somewhat unbalanced and deserving of no recognition or status. And that is a very powerful thing.
Well, the entire subject, of course, has been treated by the by officialdom and the media as a farce, really. The demonstration of the often made accusation that some of our major newspapers, whom I will leave unnamed, are conduits for the CIA and the DIA. Incidentally, most people don't realize that the CIA is fairly substantial, but the DIA and its personnel is about five times larger and more complex and more devious than the company is. However, various considerations regarding the assassination and by the way, once in a while I'll get an email saying that I've read your book or read an article or something, and I hadn't heard of you before, and it may be because I have not been at gone to great lengths to appear in fora and public activities. However, when I began, among my friends were Sylvia Marr and Epstein and Mark Lane, and, in other words, all the first generation people. I never knew Penn Warren personally.
Penn Jones.
Penn Jones personally. I guess that was wishful thinking. I would have liked to know Robert Penn Warren, who was a fine novelist.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew so many of those people at the time. Oh, Bud Fensterwald, who incidentally was to be the counsel to the House Select Committee, and then a couple of the members, from whatever sources, got the idea that his connection with the Intelligence Committee, the intelligence community, might be too great, and so he was blocked from that post. But that's whether he was or wasn't is another story. However, the evolution of the inquiry into the assassination, which began with probably no more than six or eight books, then became 16 or 20, and then became 60 or 70, and then became 600. Now I am told there are over 1,000 books that have been written on the assassination. And obviously, 90% of those are written by people who read other books and are writing books about the books they read,
mm-hmm.
and never did any individual research, never did any individual interviews. I did many scores of interviews, and Mark Lane, I know, did over 150 interviews for his book. Epstein did a great many. Sylvia Marr did a number, although for personal reasons of health and such, she wasn't able to run about the way some of the other investigators were. But time progressed, one began to get books about books, and then books about books about books, one wonders what is the psychology of somebody who feels they can make a contribution to an analysis of how and why Kennedy was killed by reading three or four other books and quoting them without attribution. And that is the characteristic of 90% of the books that have come out in the last 30 years. So if one is any interested in the subject, by the way, there are exceptions. There are more recent books that are valuable. Sometimes names escape me.
I've spoken about some of them in the past and in other shows. I've interviewed some of the other authors. Ed Haslam, Bill Davey, among others,
Bill
have written
Davey,
good
yes,
books.
That's the name I wanted. Bill Davey and the one who did the book with Lisa.
There was Destiny Betrayed by Jim Eugenio about
yes,
the
right.
Garrison investigation.
Those
it's a very,
are very
good one.
Very good. And there are excellent follow-ups. I mean, if one has read Sylvia Marr and Epstein and Bud Festerwald and who are some of the Penn Jones and so, and then wants to update, you can kind of pretty well skip about two decades and then read those two because they are. Have a familiarity with the original research and have actually done some further investigation based upon new evidence, and would give one a pretty general picture of what happened, as much as we'll ever know.
And Harold Weisberg and Peter Dale Scott are a couple of other names that
you've
mentioned in
there. Well, he's marvelous for material. He's one of the worst writers the world has ever known, but his research is very good, and he simply wasn't a writer. He was a researcher, and he did so much, you know, Whitewash 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and other New Orleans and other books,
mm-hmm.
And they're just for information. I recommend them wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
He was very important. Leo Savage was interesting to see what a foreign point of view would be of the assassination. Joachim Yeston, interesting again for the foreign point of view. Each of these early works had much to be said for them. It's just after you get past, 71, 72, you start getting into the repetition books, reprises of things that have already been done, and it literally went on for decades that nobody was saying anything new. They were simply, I'd pick up in a volume by X, Y, or Z, and I'd say, well, yes, he's taken chapter one from Marr, he's taken chapter three from Epstein, he's taken chapter five from Harold. So it wasn't until you got to Davey the other one you just mentioned.
Eugenio. Ed Haslam is also
done
Eugenio.
Yeah, then you started getting original work and inventive work, and that is is a well worth reading, and is a continuation of the original research by the original researchers.
One of the things that I've done over the years, Paris, is to excerpt many of what I feel are the most important works and read them on the air so that listeners can listen. For example, Guns of November Part 4 features a long excerpt from the Kennedy Conspiracy from 69 where I read about Permandex and the Centro Mondiale Commerciale and the international connections of Clay Shaw. And because there was a whole lot of stuff going on in New Orleans. But we're down to the last couple of minutes here, Paris. And what I'd like to do would be to ruminate. We want to get another plug in for the books, but you know under the second Bush's administrations, there have been obviously a great many overt violations of constitutional principle and all kinds of other things. And yet, as egregious as many of those have been, it's left me past a point feeling somewhat jaundiced. Bottom line, how do you expect to maintain habeas corpus when there's no habeas corpus for the President of the United States in a crowded, sunlit, urban downtown area, when they can put down the President of the United States like he was a pimp on a downtown Saturday night and nobody cares, and a congressional select committee is formed and finds there's a conspiracy and nobody cares? How in the world, how in hell can you expect to have habeas corpus when there's no habeas corpus, when they have the body, and they had the body of the President of the United States? You can't expect to have any rights at all if you're not willing to ensure the integrity of the body politic.
No, well, the tragedy is that when something like that happens for a week, it is a tragedy. And for a month, it is a news story. For a year, it may make a magazine article. After that, it's just history, and no one has any emotional contact with it. There's no visceral response to the horror of what actually happened. But if one has any sensitivity at all, despite the fact that there's no question in my mind that it was adjusted in a number of ways, if one looks at the Zapruder film and just sees the car coming along and knows that the President of the United States is then going to be murdered in cold blood, I still find it disturbing, to say the least. And yet, on the other hand, as I say, there's no question in my mind that the tape itself was manipulated, I guess is the word I want, in one way or another. But it represents, in a sense, the event, and so is moving and tragic if one ignores the evidential disparity of between the fact and the film.
Tell people how to get your book.
Yes, it can be gotten by one, write to ScanUscription, S as in Sam, ScanUscrypton Books, Box, Post Office Box 4848, Scioto, SCIOTA, Pennsylvania, PA, 18345. Or just write to Assassination of America, all lowercase, all one word, ASSASSINATIONOFAMERICA.com. That's my website, and you'll find all the information you will need.
All righty, and that concludes For the Side 2 of For the Record Program number 626, Converse Interview with Paris Flamand, A Whole New Form of Government. This is being recorded on February 24th of the year 2008. For Paris Flamand, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.